Hello everyone, and welcome to our brand new podcast, The Intellect Dissect. My name is Pippa. I am the Deputy Head Girl of St. Teresa's School, and I, along with Head Girl Liv and Deputy Head Girl Emma, are hosting this very exciting first ever episode of St. Teresa's School podcast for you. At St. Teresa's, we have five school values: community, compassion, character, faith, and intellect. Every year, we focus on one value, and this year, it is the turn of intellect, which is why we're bringing this podcast to you. So, in today's episode, which is all about the history of the school, we are going to be hearing some amazing stories about what the school used to be like from people who've experienced it firsthand. We hope you'll love listening to them, since you'll have the opportunity to learn so many things about your school that you didn't know. And you're going to be hearing these stories from some very special guests, Miss Nelson, Mrs. Gardner, and Mrs. Ford. So, let's start from the beginning. Can you tell us about how the nuns came to start a school in Effingham?
The Mother General of the Nuns' Order, which was situated in Belgium, saw an advert for a country house to be sold, and she'd always wanted to open a school in England, or a finishing school, not a school like this, but a, you know. And so she came over with a couple of other nuns to sort of look at it, and she liked what she saw, and it was agreed that she would buy it. So she went back to Belgium and spoke to one of the most junior nuns, who was 22, Sister Teresa, and said, "I'd like you to go to England and start this school." Sister Teresa was extremely reluctant because, A, she didn't speak any English. She knew nothing about England at all. But she prayed very hard and decided that, yeah, that's what she should do. So she came over here with, there were eight nuns who came with her, three of whom went back fairly soon. They just helped to settle in. But their journey over here was fairly fraught. And when they actually arrived in England, they hadn't really a clue where the school was. And they couldn't say, and well, they did keep saying, St. Teresa's School, St. Teresa's School. But it wasn't. Hadn't been named then, it hadn't been named St. Teresa's, that they, nobody knew where there was a convent. And she said, "We spent hours driving around Leatherhead and Dorking, with me praying desperately that we would never find the school and that I would have to go back home again." But the one of the nuns who was with her, who was in charge of the finances, was equally praying hard because she didn't want to waste the money that they'd spent on the carriage and everything else. And she said God listened to the money. And so we ended up finding the school and they came here. So she was here and she was ended up as the head of the whole sort of order here. And over the years, more and more nuns came and joined them. And I think we probably both remember quite a few teaching nuns. Mm. But there were also a lot of nuns that I rather mistakenly called working nuns, because that makes it sound as if the teaching ones didn't work. But and I've got in my mind, it was between 25 and 30 nuns in total, that sort of number. Mm. And they did absolutely everything. They did all the cooking, all the gardening, all the cleaning. They did all the decorating. I think the only thing they didn't do was really heavy manual building works. And I certainly never saw any of the nuns on the back lawn, which then was much larger than it is now because there wasn't the prep school or anything there. Never saw them on a little, you know, tractor or anything like that. But they did everything else. And one of my fondest memories is of Mother Teresa. And she loved gardening. And she also loved playing the cello. Not that she ever did them together, but she was seeing her trundling with her wheelbarrow and her habit tight up into her belt. The atmosphere in the school was very much one of religion. And now, as I said before, I'm not a Catholic, and it wasn't something that was in any way oppressive. They were lovely, lovely people. Mm. I can't emphasise that enough. Mm. And I sometimes get quite cross when you see things in the paper about nuns in some schools, and other countries too, that have treated children and adults very badly, because there was never any suggestion of that here. They were lovely. And you talked about your five, was it five core values?
Yes.
And we mentioned earlier, Janet Nye. Janet said, we didn't have that then.
No, we didn't need pictures on the wall telling us what our values were, because the nuns lived out the values in front of us.
They were absolutely superb. They were incredibly kind. I mean, I hadn't been here very long. As I say, I came in 1968, and within a few weeks, I had a very serious asthma attack. I'm asthmatic, and it was the chalk from the chalk, you know, using chalk on a board. Yeah. And then the head then, Sister Magdalene, she changed all the chalk to what was the new invention of dustless chalk, so you could chalk and no dust was produced. I mean, of course, a few years later we had whiteboards, but that was
quite a long time.
Later.
But, I remember chalk boards.
But they were very kind, and they would always help you. They were very generous of spirit. And you could never do anything back for them, really, because when Christmas and birthdays and that came, if you were to give, for instance, I was particularly friendly with Sister Catherine, who's been mentioned already, who came here actually as a pupil and then went to art college. And she was a really gifted artist, and she came back here with her own sister and they to take their vows and that here. But if I'd wanted to give her a birthday present, supposing I gave her a box of three bars of soap, if she needed soap, she could keep one bar, but the other two she had to give away. And if you gave her anything that she had, like an umbrella, I mean, all very practical, they were not allowed to keep these things. They had to give them away. And I said to her once, don't you have any money? You know, this is mercenary me thinking I'd like to be spending money. And she said, well, I have pocket money every week. And I said, how much? 5p.
I very much still miss their presence in the school. Mm. And they would take, you know, so we had some girls who, let's say, they were in swimming teams, or they wanted to you know, go to a swim club. So they would drive them. So no matter what time, day or night, they would always drive any of the pupils, if somebody wants to go down to Dorking or if anybody wants to go there, they would always drive them there. If they need to have an early supper or a late supper or whatever, they would always cook or do that for them. You know, so in fact, they were, you know, they were sort of women who actually really did have a really true vocation. Mm. And it was all about doing everything for everybody that was in this school, in this community. And it very much was that. And this is what has carried on, I think, within the school still.
And I remember when my back went and I couldn't sit down, so I couldn't drive home. And Sister Catherine drove me home, and I was lying on the back seat of the school bus. And Sister Catherine's driving was something of much comment.
Are you sure it was Sister Catherine, not Sister Carmel?
Oh, no, it was Sister Carmel. Why did I say Catherine?
No, it was Carmel.
Yes, it was her. And I remember Sister Carmel telling
me... Never got out of second gear.
I remember Sister Carmel telling me...
She might hear this.
I know. That she took some girls to the cinema at the weekend, and she needed to put petrol in, but she didn't have any money, so she put petrol in, and they let her come back and get the money and go back and pay for it afterwards.
She was amazing. She would offer to drive you if you're going to the theatre or something like that. She said, I'll drive the minibus, I don't mind. And she'd drive the minibus, but her driving could have been better. But the great thing was, if you were going up to the London, for instance, and we got to the theatre, and she'd stop right outside the theatre, and she'd open the doors, and we'd all get out. Meanwhile, she's in the middle of the road with the traffic, and all the London traffic has stopped at the sight of this nun in the middle of the road. Absolutely brilliant.
Yes, absolutely brilliant. And she was in charge of the medical...
She was matron.
Yes. Sister Catherine, she learnt to drive on the school field when she was mid-70s. Mm-hmm. She actually learnt to drive and took her driving test when she was in her mid-70s, wow, which was absolutely fabulous. Mm-hmm. And she did a lot of her practice driving around the school field. There was Mother Margaret Mary... That was also Sister Margaret Mary. So depending on what position she had, she was either Sister Margaret Mary or Mother Margaret Mary. She played a mean game of pool. You think all these nuns, you know, in their community, just sitting there knitting and doing that. They're not. I tell you, they are not. But she was quite good in that. You know, she would take anybody anywhere. And we all sort of said that she knew, you know, that she sort of knew all the roads around here, but actually knew it wasn't. Actually, she actually got lost. So the reason why she actually went round a lot of the roads and the lanes around here was because she could never really find her way back. And so she was just driving around on there. But I do remember that she did write off two buses, I think. Too many buses were written off. You know, but she was a lovely, lovely, lovely lady. Mm.
How has the layout of the school changed since you were first here?
So Campion and Moore weren't here when Margaret was here. So that's science and languages. Mm-hmm. That wasn't there. It was the sports hall, the clear span?
No, it was built in
77.
No, the sports hall,
which was called a clear span because it was the make that was there. So you used to have the clear roof. So that was built, I think, in 1977. It had about a sort of 10, 12-year shelf life, so it's sort of doing pretty well.
Wow.
It has had its roof redone. It was the first thing Mr. Farmer did, because he didn't like looking at the roof.
Mag House wasn't here when you first...
No, Magden House wasn't when I first came. Obviously not Merlot, any of the very recent ones. Is there still the wall behind where... the old, very old wall, where behind where the current, the new sixth form block is?
Yes, behind
that wall when I first came, and that because that then became tennis courts.
That's tennis courts, yes.
And behind that wall were it was a huge vegetable garden, a huge kitchen garden, and with two or three large greenhouses. And the nuns grew almost everything we ate. So all the veg, all the salad was all grown there by several nuns who were just, you know, gardening nuns.
If you think of rooms 7, 8, 9, they all had a raised dais for the teacher's desk, so that the teacher could look down upon the assembled company.
Yeah, I remember saying to a class at the end of I was giving back an exam paper, and there was I'd worked out a sort of multiple choice that I thought they'd all quite like, and I said, "Do you know, it's funny. You've all of you have got one question the same." Right, everybody got that one right. Why was that? Why did that happen? And someone stuck a hand up and said, because when you were telling us about that, you fell off the end of the dais into the rubbish bin. And it just proves. That's a teaching method, actually, to make sure when you're trying to teach something that you hang something else onto it. And I did, obviously.
You were talking earlier about the sports facilities. What were the main sports the students played?
Not very much like they do now, really. It's hockey, hockey, netball, swimming, tennis, athletics, and then obviously rounders.
Yeah.
I did introduce cricket for a while. We did have a cricket wicket up on the field when that was done, because, again, when I first came, we didn't have the sports field. That was horses.
So was horse riding very much a prominent sport as it is now?
No, I think a lot of girls... went riding after school, and in fact a friend of mine who was here before as well, she was sort of saying that she used to have riding lessons, and you could bring the kids up to have children up to have riding
That's so
lessons
similar to how
and
it,
and,
isn't
and stuff like that. But it was but I don't think she ever had to pay for it. Was it Bev at that stage, I think, who, you know, so there used to be quite a lot. The boarders would then go out and go help out, muck out the ponies and stuff like that, and bits and pieces. But I don't remember them going off and doing competitions.
Now, you see, when I first came, riding was very, very strong. Quite a few of the girls lived in London, and so the parents loved the idea that there were horses here, and there were lots of horses.
I think that's one of the main attractions here.
And lots of girls brought their own horses down, not necessarily from London, but brought their own horses, which were stabled here. And it was... people did go off for competitions. There was a lot of competitions happened, and they went to sprang from the nuns who enjoyed riding. They kept donkeys, and there's something in this school history book about they used to have a false derby every year, a well-known thing that everybody would go to, and one of the nuns won it one year on her own horse, and it was made the national press that a nun had won this particular race.
Was she allowed to have her own horse?
Well, it was. She brought it and given it to the community.
To the community, for everybody to use.
Yeah. So no, this was in the, but by about the mid-70s, perhaps a bit before then, they'd stopped because it had become so expensive for the school to run it, you know, to have stable girls and the the transport that was needed and everything, so they stopped riding for many years.
It's only relatively recently.
Well, I just remember Bev having, you know, obviously, you know, she did that, and I think a lot of them were her horses and so on, but then that stopped their doing, because then we obviously needed to have a field, or why didn't we have a field? So then the horses' field then was redone as a field. So Bullimore's field, it was a chartered accountant down in Dorking. He had two daughters here, and so he sponsored for the field for drainage to be put in and stuff like that. And so then, hence, then the field. And of course, the hockey pitch wasn't an astro, it was what was known as a red grass. It was like a red clay in a way. And so that actually went down to where the top car park is, where the staff park. That was red grass. So when we came to build the astro, because we needed to go wider, and to go wider, we'd have to knock down the tree, which we couldn't knock down the oak tree. So therefore, we had to move up. Okay, so up the field. Okay, and so hence then we then had an area then to create more parking. Then the astro then has gone up a bit, and so then there's a bit of a slope, isn't it, as you come out the top end of the astro up. So of course you can see the difference in levels. So of course that was then all put over far over on the left hand side by the stables.
And it was Mary Prescott. She was the one who had the swimming pool
and the
roof,
astro.
And the lighting on the astro.
We weren't allowed to have lighting for many years. Planning permission was we could build it. We would not have any lighting whatsoever. So that has only come in the last sort of about 5 years, 6 years, because we were hiring portable lighting for about 3 years, which we had 10 of them around it, and it really still wasn't that good. But we've only had those lights maybe 5-6 years, something like that.
And of course, Merlo Hall, and all this was Mary's final pièce de résistance.
Because we named after Mother Teresa, whose surname
that was her surname Merlo. When she wasn't a nun.
Yes. And we'd had planning permission for quite some time, but nobody pushed it any further until Mary grabbed it by the scruff of its neck and got it all done.
When you talk about buildings, there's other things that have changed too. I mean, the actual look of the place, obviously, when we were all here, there was, you know, no prep school up here, all of that sort of stuff. But the other thing too, I mean, the main road is from the golf club, is it, at the bottom, is called Beech Avenue. Well, certainly when I first came, it was just solid beech trees. It was quite a different look to today. Beautiful, it really was. And then, of course, in the great storm of 87, they all came down, and the school was cut off for a fortnight, and you couldn't get to the school. And what used to happen was it was when Leslie Allen was here, wasn't it? And he used to phone all the parents of the day girls to say, your daughters are really fine, you know, there's nothing wrong with them, we just can't get them out. And they used to put them in the minibuses and drive them all across the field down into Dorking, I think. Yes, Dorking, that wasn't cut off. And for day girl parents, who would then give these girls a bath, let them watch telly, then bring them back up, you know. So they got completely cut off. But the drive, the actual, I mean, the Beech Avenue was the drive for the house originally. There were no houses on either side, because the original property here, which dates right back to pre-1066, was hundreds and hundreds of acres. And when there was a building, wasn't the school, obviously, but a building was here, the drive was all the whole of Beech Avenue and then up what is the school drive. But until relatively recently, the school drive was just covered with trees, wasn't it, either side? You know, you've got lawns. That was solid trees. And going right down where you've now got your new stables, that was all trees all down there, into which the soldiers are billeted, which more later.
Actually, now you mentioned, I think actually, in fact, your story about the Canadian soldiers.
Well, we come
soldiers.
To that later. They've probably got other questions first.
What have been the biggest changes to the school's student life?
Well, there's a tremendous stir when the first lay head was appointed, Joan Hopkins, because she allowed the girls to have their boyfriends up at the weekends.
don't think that happens today.
No.
Well, I think the internet is the most significant, and it took us ages to get that as well, didn't it?
I mean, in our lifetime, it was like computers. I mean, when computers arrived, I mean, we did have to be told how to turn them on. Honestly, because you had this box, and we all sat and you turn it on. The multi gym used to be the computer room, and before that, it was actually a music room, but it was a computer room. And if you looked at the plaque, it says it was opened by Kenneth Baker, who was the education secretary at the time. Okay, hence why Baker Street is called Baker Street. Okay, all right. So that was the computer room. So we all had some inset training. We all went in there.
We were
told to click this and click that and do this and do that. And Margaret said to me, "Yeah, did you get that?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I just did what I was told to click that, click that." Anyway, I looked over at hers.
I discovered the mouse. Okay,
and she discovered the mouse, and she'd written B U M.
Yeah. It seemed fairly inoffensive.
Fairly.
See, this was the person who was to become deputy head. So I went.
How'd you get rid of it?
I pressed it again.
How'd you get rid of it?
And again. And I said, Miss.
This sounds ever so pathetic.
So in fact, we're no different than you are, really. So that's the only things that we've had, that we had training on. I used to give you hand-me-do reports, didn't I? I used to say, look, if you just type them, I'll put them on. Right? I used to sort of give you year seven or so. I used to type them, I just put them onto the system in bits and pieces. Whereas now, she's an absolute whiz. Because she does photography and all sorts of stuff like that, really. In fact, she's in the photography world and can do absolutely marvellous things. And to be honest, when she retired, you'd never believe that.
Thank you.
Neither would you, I think.
No.
I remember when Mary came into our offices.
Mary Prescott.
Must have been about 2002, 2003, saying, "Have you got your email up?" Because up until then, we had handwritten notes.
Memos
that you put in people's pigeonholes.
In fact, when they go down, Dr. McShane gets very excited because I give her some memos that she can write on and put in people's pigeonholes. So it's just like, oh, this is like old school, you know. So that must be all right.
So just to round it off, do you have any stories you'd like to share with us?
Well, I have got one. It's not one of my own stories. It was one that was told to me. I was very friendly, as I said, with Sister Catherine, who came here as a child. And so she was here during the war. They woke up one morning to find there were loads of American and Canadian soldiers, particularly Canadian, had been billeted on them in the woods. So, of course, the girls were so excited by this. And they were told, "You must not get changed in front of the window, close the curtains, you must not meet with them." But of course there was lots of, you know, passing of notes and all that sort of stuff. But one bit of real, and she did tell me later, after the storm, the big storm in 87, when a lot of the trees came down, they found lots of bullets and all sorts of stuff in the trees from when there'd been dogfights going on above the school. Because the school, if you think of London and Portsmouth, the school is pretty much, and as an aside, in 1937, the nuns got up on the ladders and they painted the front of the school, repainted it brilliant white. When the war came, they were told they had to camouflage it because it was wonderful for the German planes coming over. But anyway, enough of that. So the soldiers were billeted here, and there were quite a few of them in the Effingham area. During the wartime, lots of people bought newspapers, much more than they do now, because they got the news that was going on. They used to only be 3 or 4 pages, but one of the things they used to love about the newspapers, there were always lots of crosswords and puzzles for them to do when they were in shelters and, you know, when they had the time to sort of while away. And one day, somebody from MI5, in doing his crossword, came across a word and thought, "Why is that here?" And it was Omaha, which, if you know anything about the Second World War, it's one of the beaches in Normandy that was used for the Normandy landings. And he was slightly concerned about this, but over the next 45 days, 8 of the names, the code, secret code names of the beaches of the Normandy landings appeared as crossword answers. And they were quite because it had already been decided, Churchill and Roosevelt had decided that the landing was going to be on June the 5th, 1944, and all the plans were going ahead. That's why these soldiers were here, because they were going to be part of the big push down to the coast, because we're very close to Brighton and all the way along there, and they're all going to go out from there. So they drove down here, a group of MI5, to speak to a Mr. Dawe, D-A-W-E, I think it was, who was head of a school in Effingham, which had transferred from London because of things were getting rather dangerous. And they brought the school down and they stayed here. And he was the crossword compiler for the Telegraph. Mm. And they really gave him a hard time as to why he had put these clues there that were... gave the answers, which were all these beaches. Mm. And he didn't really know what they were going on about, but he said, "I don't know anything about that." You know, and he managed to convince them that he actually was sort of quite innocent. What had actually happened was that security was actually quite lax, and a lot of the local lads and girls had got to know some of these soldiers very well, and some of them would come up here, they'd meet down in Effingham. And the soldiers quite like some of the boys, because they'd got children of their own back home. The boys loved it because they'd got chocolate and they let them play with their guns, and you know, it was a very nice sort of relationship. But the soldiers, being slightly loose-lipped, often they knew these names of these beaches, but they didn't know what they related to. And so when Mr. Dawe said to his pupils, as he often did, "Give me a load of words I can use in my crossword," they'd given him a lot of these names that could be used as answers to crossword clues. But the one that really got them was the eighth clue that was given. The answer was Overlord, and that was the title of the whole operation, Operation Overlord. Mm. But they just had to assume that it was all legit, and so it was left. Mm. And, you know, nothing happened as a result. And at the end of the war, the school all went back up to the Strand with all the boys in it, and the soldiers, Sister Catherine said, they woke up one morning and they'd just all gone. They'd just disappeared, leaving behind, you know, hats and bits of stuff. But it's quite amazing, really. But quite an adventure for the nuns, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. What a first episode this has been. And if you're hearing this message, it means you've listened to the episode all the way through to the end. And for that, we can't thank you enough. We also wish to say a huge thank you to our special guests, Miss Nelson, Mrs. Gardner and Mrs. Ford. It truly has been a pleasure talking to you, and we have loved hearing all of your amazing stories. You have set the bar exceptionally high for our next episode, which we are really looking forward to sharing. This second episode will feature some inspirational members of our school community who have represented our nation at sporting events. So if you are desperate to hear some more amazing stories from these athletes, please be sure to tune into our next episode of The Intellect Dissect, coming out very soon.